You're listening to the Listen Up Show, Startup Entrepreneur Podcast. I'm Mitchell Chadrow, your host. Today, we're here with Board Bench Company's entrepreneur, Nancy May, show 044.
So two rules to being a great woman. And the first rule is you have to ask for help for yourself. I don't care what your ask is or what it's about, but it has to be for yourself and nobody else. It's your time to be selfish because women are not really good at asking for help. And then the other rule is which we do extremely well, is that you open your resource and your Rolodex to the people in that particular room because they're a trusted group of individuals. And they do.
Listen up, trusted friends. It's your business. It's your family. It's your life. Now let's get started. What is Board Bench Companies?
We are a corporate governance corporation or company that works with public and private companies. We have two sides of the business, so we work with the public and private companies to help them deal with director succession, meaning recruiting, retirement of directors, board evaluations, how to make boards better and stronger at what they do, and then also we work with director compensation, so how do you pay directors properly. On the other side is we work with candidates. We have a separate section to the business and working with our aim to get on board and don't know how to get there. Coach them and how to package themselves and how to market and more aggressively out their goals.
Please sign up to my email list for the latest special offers exclusive for our Listen Up Show Startup Entrepreneur Podcast audience at mitchellchadrow.com/signup. I have been providing business advice, resources, and help to entrepreneurs for over 20 years, and I'm looking forward to helping all of you. Sign up for my email list again at mitchellchadrow.com/signup. I will provide you with full transcript for each interview, my ebook, 30 Tools to Startup, the Startup Checklist, and many other education and training materials, all back at mitchellchadrow.com/signup. Now enjoy the show. Nancy, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great this morning, Mitchell. How are you?
Super. We really appreciate you coming on. Nancy, what's the one thing that contributes most to your success?
I would say that it is a constant working towards learning new tools and resources and pieces of information that are going to add value to my business, but more importantly, more value to the clients and people that I work with. Also pushing the envelope, being as creative as possible and solving problems, and reaching out and connecting and networking, which is a good portion of what I do.
So how did you actually just get into niche where not only are you helping directors, but you're also helping women directors doing, you know, corporate governance?
Actually, I was pulled into the business years back through a client. I was doing, my background is marketing and strategy and product design and development early on in the dot-com and tech space, way back when, actually starting in the semiconductor industry. Then I went out and built my own strategy business, and a client said, geez, everything that you're doing for me as a CEO is extremely valuable. I really need the help like that in the boardroom. Can you work with me? So I started to do some work, was extremely successful for that CEO, and then others started to ask. And quite frankly, my philosophy was it was a lot easier and more enjoyable and rewarding to work at the top of the house than the middle or the bottom of the house.
Our startup round. For all your hosting needs, head on over to mitchellchadrow.com/hosting. mitchellchadrow.com/hosting for all your web hosting needs. Who do you use to host this website?
That's how I started to get into the board work. And it was early on before boards are where they are today. It was still a bit of an old boys network. And I thought that maybe the first thing to do would be only work with women in the boardroom. And as much as I support women, and I will continue to the day I die, it was the fastest way back then to get into bankruptcy, not be in a business. Because companies and boards weren't really looking for women at the time. They said they were, but they weren't so much. They are.
So was that some of your early struggles in terms of starting out in this particular niche, in that it was hard for you to basically help women, not because you didn't want to, but because it was difficult to basically get women onto boards? Tell us a little bit about those struggles and who actually helped you then continue to get your clients. How did you market yourself? How did you strategize to sort of overcome that obstacle?
Sure. So challenge was really sort of twofold. With the corporations, it was really before the conversations of getting women on board and having that strong diversity component was there. There were a lot of information and resources out there for helping women get up the corporate ladder, but there really wasn't a whole lot going on in the boardroom. And quite frankly, the women that were there. You know, forgive anybody of your listeners who may be one of those, but a lot of them really were the old guard women. They used to refer them as the queen bees. And the queen bees were noted for managing and owning their throne, shall we say, and
okay.
not really being inclusive and allowing other women into that boardroom. It was their domain.
And was that, do you think that that philosophy came because it was obviously extremely defensive, figuring that they didn't want anybody to encroach because they feared that that would somehow jeopardize their own position? So it doesn't seem like a real leadership type of mindset.
Yeah, I would say that was probably the case. The same thing in the corporate world. There were some amazing women that I worked with who were strong leaders, and then there were a few that ruled by fear, not necessarily just keeping the women at bay, but a couple of them really, you know, but my boss early on, there was one woman I remember, I was at J. Walter Thompson Advertising, and he said, don't work with Marianne, she'll cut your head off before you walk through the door. So
wow.
She ruled by fear and intimidation, and it worked very well for her, but not so much for the other people around them.
So who do you find yourself now working with? What women leaders, what companies? I know that you also work with not only corporations, but obviously individual ladies trying to get onto board. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and how you actually got your foot in the door with those companies and those individuals?
I started with referrals and networking and people who knew me and trusted me, quite frankly, and brought me in to say, we'd like to have a conversation about this. I learned what was going on in the boardroom space, what worked, what didn't work from the big global competitors and recruiters that were out there. And I tried to do something differently that was extremely service oriented, that was deep into research, exceptionally honest. I didn't have any paybacks to give to other clients that might have been, you know, general component or jobs, which happens a lot in the industry. So I was truly obligated to the needs and the values, the outcomes of my clients in the boardroom only, had no other agenda. So that
are you able to talk to us a little bit about specifics in terms of the types of companies that you've been able to sort of work with and help, and also some individuals, maybe know if they're well-known companies, or tell us a little bit about the type of clients that you're working with specifically, if you could.
Well, I will tell you about the industries and generally types of companies. I don't mention names because of confidentiality, and I sign, you know, confidentiality agreements with a lot of them. Not everybody does that, but I hold the trust that we have with our board members very, very close. So,
but do they allow you, after you've been working with them for a little bit, as well as the person that you place, to then mention who that is so that it can actually help you in gaining additional business?
Yeah, a lot of them do not, but they do, they will be served as referrals for me. So I pick up the phone and say, if I need a referral, I'll call, you know, Jim or John or Sally or Sue or whatever and say, you know, would you act as a direct referral? Here's the
situation. Yeah. So maybe the type of individuals that you work with or the type of companies, maybe that would be more helpful then.
So we only work in the boardroom. So that's our area of specialty. We don't work in vertical niches necessarily from the industry perspective, but we've worked with some of the largest financial institutions in the world, depending upon how the market is going. One in particular was in the top three, and all the way down, biotech company that was a smaller, younger company that had an outside activist investor. We've worked in sporting and consumer goods. We've worked in manufacturing. It really has run the gamut. Education, healthcare market, it has run the gamut in industries. And what I find is that boardrooms are fairly similar. They're similar in structure in many cases. It's the dynamics in the boardroom that change, and people are serving. What type of people?
Tell us a little bit about those dynamic changing in corporate governance that you see, as well as the role of obviously getting women onto the board that you have found over the decades.
Well, let's start with women first, if we may. The role or the interest of corporations bringing women on board has changed, obviously, here in the United States and worldwide, as there have been mandates put in more internationally than they have in the States. The United States here, there's a lot more pressure going on from a legislative perspective, which I'm not sure will actually happen 100% from a national perspective. I just learned the other day that Pennsylvania has mandated that by, I think it's 2020, they expect all public companies to have 30% of their board to be diverse. That includes minorities as well as women.
And how do other states then fare as it relates to that? It just so happens that I'm physically located in Pennsylvania, but the podcast goes across the U.S. So how do some of the other states, I mean, are you saying that Pennsylvania is a leader in that area?
I don't have those statistics in front of me. I can certainly find them out for you and send them on.
Yeah, that posts something, a link, that research, because I think that we would all be curious, as a lot of our audience, as you know, are women entrepreneurs, not only with their own businesses, but also with their own careers as well, professionally.
So there are a number of research organizations that are out there being tabs on what's happening state by state. ICON is one. It's a not-for-profit that has actually been working on each state initiative to look at what's happening with the number of women on public company boards. Private company boards is a little bit more difficult to find that out because the information is not always public. However, research has stated from what has been accessible is that the private company boards are even less diverse and it's more difficult for women to get on those particular boards over the years. ICON is one. CalPERS, California State Pension Program, has also done a program called 3D Directors where they have a list of women directors. Atlanta, Georgia, has a group that has a women on board. Canada has been very aggressive as well. That's obviously outside of our state, our
country. But yeah, no, that's fascinating.
They've been very aggressive in getting women on board, and maybe aggressive is not the term, but, forward and direct. And there are a number of activist funds, we'll call them, or progressive funds, that are actually only investing in companies that have more women and diversity directors on their board.
And so you talked to us a little bit about your early background as a marketing person, as a strategist. And so I know that you had also mentioned referral sources. Other than that, what other ways, I think that people would be curious to find out, how are you actually getting to these clients? You mentioned top three financial institution. It just so happens that that's my particular background as well. So I've acted as investment counsel and bank and trust counsel for major corporations, financial in nature. How did you actually get in? What have been your strategies that have worked for you? Because whether it's someone trying to get onto a board or someone who's trying to land that deal with that company, how have you been able to do it in your niche?
Well, I write for a publication called the Chief Executive Forum Magazine, which goes out to about 20,000 CEOs around the country. So that's a very tight market, something that is the audience that I need to speak to. I'm a member of a number of associations and groups that deal with CEOs and boards, so I'm visible there. I speak to different industry groups that relate to that, both from the general counsel perspective. I've spoken to general counsel, CFOs, that particular audience. I have a particular group of women in this particular case that we're a strong network of one another. Once every other month we get together. I actually call it it's Nancy's Great Women's Network. Joke, and I said there are actually two rules to being a great woman. And the first rule is you have to ask for help for yourself. I don't care what your ask is or what it's about, but it has to be for yourself and nobody else. It's your time to be selfish because women are not really good at asking for help. And then the other rule is which we do extremely well, is that you open your resource and your Rolodex to the people in that particular room because you trust. They're a trusted group of individuals, and they do. And we've been doing this for a number of years and started that, I think, probably about 3 years ago. I've been doing it for a long time.
Fascinating. Speak at one of these particular engagements. You mean to tell me a president of a major corporation just walks up to you afterwards, just starts to chit-chat and says, hey, by the way, we need somebody on our board. Can you do that search for us? I mean, how does it actually happen?
What happens typically is the conversation will say, I'd like to talk to you further about some of the work that you do. And then we'll have a phone conversation or face-to-face conversation, and I'll find out a little bit more what's going on inside the boardroom. It could be a director who's retiring. It could be somebody that had been difficult that they want to get rid of. I've had that with, one client not too long ago had actually hired or brought a director on that they knew as a friend. And then when he got into the boardroom, he was toxic. He was rude, disruptive, didn't come prepared, challenged management to a point that was not productive. It was actually disruptive. And they were uncomfortable in letting this guy go. So they lived with this thorn in their side for almost 4.5 years until they said it was time for him not to stand for re-election. Somebody was strong enough to say, hey, it's time for you to go, Joe. And or not stand for re-election is typically what they do.
On the flip side of that, you're also working with people trying to get them placed on down to the board. So your client is the individual as opposed to the corporation. Talk to us a little bit about some of the issues in working through, because that person's coming into a culture and a subculture where there might be issues. Tell us some of the things that you've had to work through in helping to place them and sort of walking them through all the various issues that the company is dealing with, basically.
So there's two sides to that. If the company is my client and I've got a lineup of prospective candidates for that particular company, we will, when we get a short list of individuals after we've reviewed them with the corporation and we've narrowed it down to a shorter list, I will have a phone conversation or an in-person conversation with every single individual explaining some of the dynamics that are going on within the parameters that we're allowed to talk about. Help them understand the personalities around the table, some of the challenges that their company is going through, why their background is of value or where there may be some uphill challenges. And so they are properly informed before they walk into an interview with a director or a group of directors. That's on that side. On the candidate coaching side, which is a separate business altogether, it's coaching individuals one-on-one who want to get on board. There are some key things that I inevitably find right across the board. I would say 95% of those individuals are not packaged properly, meaning their information on how they present themselves from an employee perspective versus a candidate perspective to serve on a board or a board peer is totally disconnected. So we typically work in the beginning on just ratcheting that up to a higher level of visibility. So they're positioned as a board person.
So talk to us a little bit about somebody who might be extremely qualified, but for whatever reason, whether it be on paper or the way that they've come across in the past, has prevented them from sort of getting onto a board. What have you coached them or what have you sort of done to help them? And on the flip side, what have you done with the company in terms of presenting the company in a more appealing way that attracts higher caliber type of individual where maybe people in the past have shied away from it because they don't want to sort of deal with all the chaos and all the various issues?
Sure. So on the candidate side, the candidate coaching side, I'll give you two examples. One was female and one was male. Female was really reported right into the CEO, was a vice chairman level, extremely competent and talented individual, but she just didn't know how to present her accomplishments in a quantifiable and valued way from a board perspective. Once we were done with work, you know, we worked back and forth. I don't do the work directly. I coach the individual to own their work and walk through this with them very tightly. Every week we have phone calls and conversations about how to do this, and they work through the process. At the end, I'll take it and we'll tweak it and polish it up a little bit. But they have to own the material. They lived it. I haven't. And if they can't speak to it, somebody else, then we failed. But at the end of about 7 weeks, she looked at the material and I said, you know, and I'll use the term named Susie. I still use Susie and Joe, sort of my general terms with when I'm talking about these individuals. So Susie, what do you think about this person now that's on paper? And she actually, you could hear her light up on the phone. She goes, oh my God, I don't recognize this person. I said, but it's you. It's everything you've done. We've done nothing different than they highlight and bring your great accomplishments to the forefront. She goes, I know that. I just didn't know how to uncover it myself. So, and she's out there, you know, networking. It's changed the conversation totally from where she was before.
No, I think because this is such a high niche, you know, board governance, working with not only women going onto a board, how do you structure how you get paid at the end of the day? I think people would be curious for their own business in terms of how they structure their own compensation. How do you do that? Because with someone like that, you're hand-holding a lot more than someone who's already polished, who's already very sharp, and sort of you're able to present them in a quicker manner. So how do you compensate yourself for those cases that are a little bit more challenging?
Well, if I find that there's a little bit more challenge, I typically, you know, put a higher fee on it. But it's a fee for service for the coaching. I have very, depending upon after initial conversation, I do what I call, you know, an upfront conversation where we really just sort of go through a deep dive and I present them with an overview of where I think they are, where I think their challenges are, where I think their opportunities are, and where I think the roadblocks are going to be and how we can work together. And I give them typically three options. options, you know, package A, B, or C. And the first could be just putting your material together so they're packaged properly and ready to mark themselves by themselves. And then the others are, you know, hand-holding, then consulting and coaching them through the process.
In terms of numbers, just to kind of go a little bit deeper, is there a formula? Is it based on what the person's salary was? Is it based on a number of hours provided? Is it based on what the overall package might be with a particular corporation? Talk to us a little bit about how those three packages look.
So for the individual coaching, I set them up based on sort of deliverables or time frames. The first one is deliverables. So if we're packaging somebody, that's obviously a bio and a CV, and that's it. End of story, we're done. Typically runs about 7 to 10 weeks, so I've got a set fee for that, knowing what's going to happen. On the coaching side, the process of how you get on a board, I do it based.
Can you give us a rough guess? Like, how many clients would you work with in that space in a 52-week and in 1 year's period of time?
I'm very selective, so I can work from. I haven't actually looked at it from a 52-week time period, to be honest with you. I haven't counted them up, but typically I'll work with no more than about five or six at a time.
And a flat fee might range anywhere from.
Oh, flat fee.
Can you give us an idea?
Yeah, flat fee on that will range from about $12,500 on up to about $19,000, depending upon the difficulty and complexity of that package alone.
Sure. And then on the corporation side, how does the corporations then sort of compensate you, and what are some of the issues with the packages that you work with through with them?
So a corporation, if you're dealing with a director succession, it's a flat fee, because we don't work like a regular search firm would, based on a percentage of salary. And on the board side also, I want to add that we will work with corporations to coach them through the process. So if they want to own it and do it themselves, we'll do that as well. And on the low side for that, we're dealing about, you know, $30,000, and it's a quick in and out type of thing.
Corporation is hiring you?
Corporation is hiring to do, in this particular case, I'm talking about a review of one individual that they may have looked at and say, we want to do an independent review. How do we do and go through that? So that would be a fairly inexpensive type of product or service. So we're doing about $30,000 there.
And how many of those might you do in a typical year?
Oh, that could be about 25, 30. Yeah.
Candidates.
Correct.
And what other types of things would the corporation then hire you to sort of revenue? In terms of scalability, some of the entrepreneurs out there scale up and sort of hire more people. Others are solopreneurs, and it's sort of themselves, and you could only be at one place at one time. And so people are curious as to how you actually structure that in terms of, are you capped at what you can sort of earn in this particular niche?
Yeah, we are a very niche-oriented business. I do not work below the boardroom. So of the kind of business we're in is not scalable as if it were a general search firm, which is very different. And I'll be honest with you with that. It's what it is. It's a small to medium-sized business, something that we've done extremely well on personally and professionally, and I love the work that we do. So, and we're trusted and respected. But on the board search side itself, that ranges from, on the low side, we're doing $75,000, and it goes to about $150,000 per individual candidate.
And how many of those might you do in a year's time? This gives the audience the ability to appreciate your business and sort of kind of takes them inside a little bit in terms of helping them appreciate a little bit about what you're doing day to day.
Sure, I understand. That ranges depending upon what's going on in the market from, it could be, you know, small. It could be doing 10 of them on up to about 25 or 30 of them.
And in terms of your own competition, again, at this level, because it's not below the board, it's at the board level, with not knowing the industry as well, obviously, as you do, can you talk to us a little bit about competition out there? I mean, obviously, you say it's not scalable. I mean, there must be, you know, entities out there that are much larger in terms of just the numbers of people, in terms of the quantity. So can you talk to us a little bit about, at this level, what type of competition you sort of face?
So we actually face a lot of competition from the large global search firms. They're big names that everybody knows out there. What they are dealing with is not just the boards. The boards are the board practice is actually small, not dissimilar to the size of our business. It's the their business that is large. It's the recruiting and the search work and the consulting work in the C-suite and below. So finding CEOs, finding CFOs, recruiting CIOs or tech people. It could be CFOs, accountants, junior level people. That's where the scalability is in hiring and coaching, shall we say, executive coaching of the executive team, the body of the corporation and this business.
Talk to us a little bit about, it looks as if you have a lot of past and current experiences with several advisory boards. I mean, I see here Neurosonics Incorporated, Economic Ventures. I know that you had mentioned being involved with a women's forum group. So I see here International Women's Forum, Economic Club of New York. I mean, talk to us a little bit about that, because how do you sort of balance being involved with all of that and then your day-to-day stuff here at the company?
It's tough at times. I have taken them on usually one or two at a time from a board perspective or an advisory role. I actually, in each particular case that I'm working with, either on a board or advisory board role, will be very specific about my time and availability, and they will let me know what they need from me. If a board or a group, it could be entrepreneurs or others that need my help and support, cannot do that, then I will typically pass. I need to know exactly what's expected to me, why, and where I can be of help. Otherwise, if I can't get that information, I find it's of no value to them. And it can be a waste of my time. We're chasing, we're herding cats, as they say. In fact, I was just advising a young company that's starting up a not-for-profit who have great respect for the founders, and they are just asking anybody who's writing a check to be on their board. And I said, absolutely not. You don't have to do that. This is what you need to do. So I gave them some advice on how to structure what it is they look for. So I'm waiting to see what that that board role job description is from them at the moment so that I can help them make the right decisions on.
And so specifically with Economic Ventures, for example, here it says, that you're the chairman of the board. How did you get involved with that? Tell us a little bit about that and give us some insight there.
Yeah, Economic Ventures is an education organization, and they work with middle and high school students to teach them entrepreneurship and how to create sustainable businesses versus just hobby jobs. And they've been extremely successful. It was, I'll call it a spinoff from the Kauffman Foundation, which was taken out by a woman, run by a woman, Carrie McIndoe, out of New York. Carrie is an extreme entrepreneur. She's a terrific lady, and started in the venture capital world up in Boston. And we've been friends for, I'd say, probably about 25, 30 years.
And so it's a not-for-profit, correct?
Correct. Correct.
Interestingly enough, a few months back, we had on Tracy Rossman, who actually started Tech Girl, which actually works with middle school children in the tech space, just because a lot of girls at that level are not going into technology heading into high school. So when it talks about entrepreneurship, how have you been able to sort of get into these schools and sort of build this nonprofit? Because it's a very, I have two girls myself, so it's an interest to a lot of people. And so how have you been able to do that?
Working in the school space is very difficult. They have budgets, they have timelines. And what Carrie has done is actually gone around the school system on the outside and do them as off school or off school hour type of program. There's a lot that goes on in the summertime for vacation period, and then one-on-one smaller groups that are going on throughout the school year after school system. So she's done that. She's also worked with community groups. There's a number of large church and religious groups that she's worked with where they are concerned about the quality of the education and the future of their children. And that has been very successful for her, including with state and government organizations that are looking at economic development down the road. How do you make sure that these children have an opportunity to grow and become independent, successful kids, successful adults?
So as a nonprofit, I think you had mentioned the Kauffman Foundation. I'm not sure if right. You did or not, but how does it generate money in terms of, do you charge? Are these after school courses? I know that with Tech Girls, for example, example, they actually created their own and a downloadable on their website. So what does Economic Ventures do to
revenue? Their revenue model is it charges a fee-for-service program, so they charge for that. They also have grants and donors that get involved in the organization. The state funding has done state grants to do programs and support them as well.
And is that the same type of thing as Economic Club of New York here on your resume?
No. Yeah, the Economic Club of New York is a very different organization. I am not on the board there. I'm a member of that particular organization. It's a very well-known, old-established organization of economists literally from around the country and in many cases, you know, around the world that come in to talk about the state of the economy, finances. They're now starting to add some entrepreneurs. They had Brian Chesky, who is the founder and CEO of Airbnb recently there. Howard Schultz will be coming soon to talk about what's happening in Starbucks. Hillary Clinton has been there over the years. Donald Trump, when he was running for office, whether you like him or not to get political here on either of theirs, Ben Bernanke would come and talk about the state of the economy. So it's an incredible opportunity to meet and learn and get to know some of the most brilliant minds in economic growth in the country.
And are you still involved on the advisory board at Neurosonics? And if so, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what they've been involved there?
Yeah, Neurosonics winding down right now. It was really sort of ahead of its time. And, you know, I wouldn't say it's lost its way, but Neurosonics was a really incredible set of technologies that was able to use brainwaves to project images onto tactical maps. They were looking to get into the government and do a lot of work from military and strategic planning. But it was a futuristic type of way to use headsets and brainwaves to project.
It's interesting you said that it was ahead of its time and it's winding down. So it doesn't sound like when I hear someone say that, you know, I hear that it might not have been as successful as one might have thought. And so, but you learn a lot from those failures, or at least what you've learned along the way. So can you talk to some of the entrepreneurs out there in terms of lessons learned so that you can impart some wisdom as they look to their own businesses in terms of what to avoid or what to do? Because, you know, they're working on all different types of technology.
Right. I would say, you know, the biggest challenge I think a very talented and creative entrepreneur has is probably not to be what I call bleeding edge versus leading edge. Getting too far ahead of a curve when the market's not able or available to accept or use an idea or an outcome is very challenging, and it's frustrating for the entrepreneur. I've seen it a number of times. And so the market is just not ready to accept or embrace either a product or a service. And it does happen. The best thing to do is try and figure out when you can be, as one corporation I worked with in the past, they never like to be a front leader. They like to be a fast second.
Sure. And that's why we talk about validating your idea. In other words, going out, testing a smaller segment of the market to see if it's even a viable option, in terms of, you know, will people pay true dollars for that product or service, before totally scaling up.
You're right. The other thing I think, and I've seen this a number of times, whether it be a product or service oriented type of entrepreneurial business, is that if you are uncomfortable selling, if you don't like to go out and talk to people and make a transaction, you know, have a cash transaction happen at the end, then don't get into business for yourself. It's very difficult.
And maybe because we've talked about teams, and I'm going to be asking you about yours in a little bit, but where maybe some of your strengths might not lie, bringing somebody in, whether as a contractor or as an employee or somebody who has those skill sets that you don't have to sort of complement what it is that you're doing, whether it be a co-founder or what have you. Would you agree?
I would agree. I still would say that the entrepreneur themselves has to be able to be comfortable making a sale, making a transaction. Putting the sale responsibility on somebody else is very difficult to make it work in the beginning. And I just, you know, see time and time again, unless they're actually an owner and have pain that's going to happen if it doesn't close or things don't close.
But sure.
I think that's key number one for everything.
We've already spoken about a lot of the boards and a lot of the other involvement that you've had, but in terms of your community involvement, especially with two girls myself, it says here that You were on the board there in Connecticut for the Girl Scouts. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you got involved with that and some of the good works that you were doing there?
Oh, I love my time on the board with the Girl Scouts. It was exciting and frustrating at the same time. So I was a Girl Scout. I started out in Brownies. My mother was a Girl Scout leader, and I'm still close friends with some of the girls, now women, that were also Girl Scouts with me and their moms that were our leaders. A friend was on the board locally and said that to me that they were looking for other directors or people to join the board of directors. And I asked what that entailed, and she explained and gave me an outline. And I said, well, I'd actually love to be able to give back to girls, because I was a Girl Scout. And so I was invited to join the board. At the time, they did not necessarily have a detailed job description. When I got there and eventually ended up chairing the Nominating and Governance Committee, that changed. So, because quite frankly, over time, they had people who came on and didn't do the work. And so if we don't know what the roles and responsibilities are, and what's expected of us, how can we commit, or how can the organization even be happy with the outcomes of the individuals that are on the board?
You know, two of the fun facts that I uncovered about you, and I'll just get you to sort of comment on. The one I thought was really cool, and I want to, you know, and here you could sort of brag a little bit. You know, we talk about, you know, you have to ask, you got to be a little, you know, you got to reflect. It says here that the United States Small Business Administration honor as State of Connecticut's Women's Business Advocate of the Year. So how does one sort of get thrown in the ring for that? How do you sort of gain that type of visibility to sort of rise above all the other, because I'm sure the competition was kind of steep that year. So how does someone like yourself do that? I know that you've already spoken to us about how you write and how you go out and put yourself out there and lecture, but you know, that doesn't tell us how you sort of still then went ahead above and beyond and differentiated to sort of get that.
Well, in that year, or in that era then, I had also been voted in as president of an organization called the Entrepreneurial Women's Network in Fairfield County, Connecticut, which was a 165-member organization that I joined based, because I saw an article when I first went into business for myself now 28 years ago. And I said, God, I'm all by myself. I saw this great article about other women getting together. Why don't I, like a friendly group, I just go and join them at their lobster bake, which I did. And one thing led to another. As I said, if you don't want to be charged with the responsibility, keep your mouth shut. And I just kept opening my mouth saying, have you thought about this? Can we do this? And so I opened my mouth one too many times, and they said, we'd like to nominate you as president. And I thought, okay, what does that entail besides what I've seen and I've learned? But they had 165 members, and they were losing 40% of their members a year, which was not a positive way to move into a leadership role. So I thought, okay, we've got to make some changes. We did some structural and strategic changes to the organization. We also changed out the board. This was one of my early governance involvements, too, where we had a board of about 35 people, and I asked everybody to resign and retire. And we restructured the board to a board of 8 people. And we went from 165, losing 40% a year, to 425 members in a year. National recognition of groups wanting to, or people wanting to start EWNs around the country. And that was, you know, one of the ways that I gained, you know, visibility. I loved the work that I did there, and it was exciting, and I learned a whole hell of a lot, and I got great business from it, too.
And there's so much power in that story, but the most powerful thing that I want the people in the audience to sort of take away from it is that from reading one small article, which obviously wasn't so small, you actually took some action and sort of moved towards that. And from that, it opened up all of these various doors. You know, a lot of people are out there thinking, you know, how can I get in, or how can I make this possible, or whatever. There's just one small little thing that might be the difference between either getting in or not getting in. It's just a matter of putting yourself out there. And I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I would say the one key word to all of this is never be afraid to ask for anything. I don't care what it is. But never be afraid to ask.
You know, it's interesting. I always tell my girls, if you don't ask me, the answer is always no. So they've learned that
there is no answer.
So they've learned that if they, you know, the answer still may be no, but if they don't ask, right? It'll always stay no. So you never know. I might surprise you. And on more than one occasion I have, because I knew what they were doing, and I said, you know what, I'm gonna say yes now because of the initiative that they took to just merely ask. So that's also kind of a cool story there. You know, the other cool thing that I saw here, and without obviously getting too political, is it says you were invited to meet President Clinton as a nation's top business leader. So did you actually get to meet President Clinton?
I did. I was on stage with him. I mean, it was.
Tell me all about that, because people love that. They want to know, how did you actually make that happen? People don't get to meet presidents.
No, they don't. And you'll laugh. You're talking about your kids. My husband, you know, I came home from that event that night, and he said, "So what happened?" And he just sort of turned red. He said, "You didn't like. Oh, raise your hand and do something silly, did you?" And I said, "No, I did nothing silly." But, you know, he's always knows that if there's a way for me to wiggle my way in a door, I will get there. So, in this particular case, I got a call from the Democratic committee, who said, you know, the president is coming into town. We've invited some of the country's top, small business leaders to be part of the conversation, and we'd like to invite you. And I thought, oh, geez, you know, I really don't have a lot of time. I was like, wait a second. It's the President of the United States. How often do you get that opportunity?
Not very often.
Right. So I said, okay, I guess I can afford the day off. And I went down to where he was in Stamford, Connecticut. And we were all sitting in an audience. And I didn't realize that it was just Connecticut. These were 500 small business owners from around the country. They came as far away from as Alaska. I had no idea. So it was a real honor that I was not aware of what a privilege it was. And then somebody from the stage came down and said, "We have one seat left on the stage, and we need to fill it. Is there anybody who would like to sit?" Before he finished the sentence, I was up and next to him and running down the stage.
So at the time that the person contacted you, you knew that you were going to go down to hear him speak, but you had absolutely no idea that you were going to actually then at some point possibly be up on stage with him.
Correct.
And out of curiosity, how was it that the person who invited you there, what were you doing in your community that made them contact you to even invite you in the first place?
Mitchell, I wish I knew that answer. I don't know. I mean, I just got a call the night before to say, "You've been selected. Would you like to come?" And
you never found out exactly how it was that you were selected, or who said, "Hey, you need to contact this person," or what have you. And so the interesting thing about it is that there's so many different opportunities. You just never know. And I'll bet you the story is that you probably met somebody there that you're probably still in contact with to this day. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I don't think there's anybody there that I met at that particular event that I'm still in contact with. But there have been people in the government that are passed across. We've stayed in loose contact. Carol Browner, who was second in charge of the EPA, I met in Washington, and I remember her asking me, "What's it like to be an entrepreneur?" And, cause she was concerned about leaving the administration. At the end of every administration, they all change out. And she was nervous, you know, about doing this, and going out. She was having a child that was going to go into college soon. She was thinking about going into business with another individual out of the administration. And I said, "Carol, I would much rather be an entrepreneur because I'm in control of my future. I know what I can do. I can get anywhere I particularly want as an entrepreneur as long as I work at it. You in government, you have to look for a job every 4 years. I don't want that job." And she didn't understand it.
it is quite a different mindset, is it not?
Yes. She also wanted to know what it was like emotionally to be an entrepreneur. And I've used this with friends before. And I said, well, at any stage of the game, there are highs and lows. So I've never had this illness, but I said, my sense is it's kind of like being bipolar. You can be up in the morning, down at lunch, and flying high again by dinner time. And every day is an exciting ride, no matter how you mark it. But it's yours to make it succeed. And to me, that's the joy.
That's awesome. Our fast pitch, MitchellChadro.com/books for books, audiobooks, guest recommendations, and the books that I read to start up each day. Sponsors are Fast Pitch, my book club recommendations back at MitchellChadro.com/books. To see more of my recommendations and recommendations of our guests, just go to MitchellChadro.com/books. It's your number one resource for book reviews and recommendations. So can you tell us about a book that's influenced you, whether it be in business, personal, or life?
Well, I've just recently read a book called Bettyville. And Bettyville is a story about a gentleman who was a writer in New York who basically gave up his life to take care of his aging mother. And I'm dealing with that right now with my parents, who I love very dearly. Time-consuming, but it gave me great thoughts, and it was a wonderfully written book. I loved it.
Well, you know, it's interesting about taking care of a parent that's obviously getting older, and the circle kind of comes full circle around, where they took care of you while you were growing up, and now you're in the process of doing the same. And the podcast is not just about entrepreneurship and business; it's about business, family, and life, and how people obviously balance all three of those. And one of the things that we didn't get into earlier in the podcast, because sometimes these questions will elicit other things from our guests, is that how do you then balance taking care of your parents, obviously having a business and having other employees that are also dependent upon you as well, and then you have outside involvement with community activities, and I'm sure it's a challenge.
It is a challenge. I really consider it very rewarding, because there's so many things. My dad was an entrepreneur too. He took over a business from his father. So I had that sort of role model growing up.
And what type of business did they have?
My dad designed and manufactured eyeglass frames. So all the frames that Elton John and Jackie O and the politicians were famous for wearing, those are my dad's.
Wow.
Yeah.
So just a really neat niche like that, because when you think of, people are trying to come up with ideas. Hey, what can I do? And here, that particular idea, I don't know how many people would think of, hey, let me do that. But yet, very successful and a very, very specialized niche, again, because of the higher quality and the higher design, correct?
Absolutely. And I'm still learning some of the things that he did. Dad will be 97 this year that I didn't know about that are coming out. So that's pretty exciting. So I'm,
yeah.
I balance it by, it's a different, I consider it really a side business, because that's what I'm doing, managing their finances, their care, their housing, all their, all investments that they've got, medical issues. It's just, I put my business hat on and say it's Mom and Dad LLC.
You know what? I love it. And it almost sounds like a totally another podcast show that we could actually do just geared towards that. So what happened to the business?
I learned about unions. They struggled through the union challenges in New York. They eventually moved the business from New York, where I grew up originally, up to Massachusetts, and revitalized. We turned around the business, and my dad sold the business to his brother, who desperately wanted it. My mom wanted out. He said, let's retire. So he sold the business to his brother, and unfortunately, my uncle didn't like to sell, and the business went downhill from there.
And when we've talked before about succession planning and working with the second and third generation, and how do you have a cohesive legacy plan within the business? Just very interesting. As far as productivity goes, we've heard the saying there's an app for that. So what would you say is an app that you use all the time, whether it be in business, family, or life, that has really helped you quite a bit?
Well, productivity and focus. I'm not sure there's an actually app per se, one that I use, but one that I've recently started to use is Focus at Will. It's a site called Focus at Will.
Okay.
And I just put my headphones on when I need to close everything out, and audio design tool that helps the brain just stay, can totally focus on what it is you're doing at the time. And I found that to be very helpful.
We talk to a lot of startups, and they're trying to get started. That is a website. And so we talk to them about, well, who do you use for hosting? Who's good? Like I use HostGator, for example, to host my numerous niche sites or whatever. So who do you work with? Who do you use?
There's a fellow here in Connecticut that has series of servers that I rely on, and he's been a solid source. So I don't use a GoDaddy or anything like that. I use his business, and he takes care of everything. We've got got our site designed on a platform called Concrete 5 so that any one of us here can go in and make changes and edit the content. We're not reliant on an outside, tech person to do that for us, which I prefer because it gives us the fluidity of what we want to put in there and when we want to take things off.
And the last question in this round really goes again toward being resourceful, because one of the things that our entrepreneurs like to do is leverage resources. They can't go out and hire, let's say, a graphic designer, and so they have to rely on other means. And so for me, like, I use Canva quite a bit for my own graphic design and my photos. So who do you use, or who do you work with?
Well, actually, I rely on myself a lot, quite frankly, because I had a degree when I'd taken some time off and did a degree in commercial advertising and design as well. So I have a good sense of design, and I know what I like and what I don't like.
Do you use a tool, though? I mean, to sort of complement what it is that you're doing, and obviously you're doing a lot of writing, as you had mentioned before, and you do a lot of speaking engagements. So is there something that helps complement, for those out there who, let's say, don't have that type of background?
Well, most recently I was having problems with presentation. I needed some PowerPoint, and it wasn't looking good. So I called a friend and hired her to do the work and lay it out, and that was a PowerPoint presentation. So I use Photoshop when I need it, trying to think of, I'm not doing a whole lot of print work because we don't need to do the print work. It's the basic desktop publishing tools that we're using. Nothing particularly fancy.
We mentioned your team. I know you have an advisory committee, and I know that you have a few employees. So can you just briefly tell us a little bit about their backgrounds, kind of give the audience a little bit more in depth as to the company and your capabilities there?
Sure. My advisory team are a group of individuals who have been CEOs and senior leaders, both public companies as well as entrepreneurial corporations. I rely on them for many as a sounding board or making sure I'm making the right decision. And in some cases, getting some input and say, okay, I heard that was then, this is now, I need to make my own decision. So that's been very helpful. They've opened doors for me, which has been good. My team, I'm the front person. That's always the way it has been. People call me my brand and my name that they know. Behind the scenes, I've got writers, researchers, tech people as I need them.
Our wrap-up round, MitchellChadrow.com/photo for all your graphic design needs. So what are the three main takeaways that people can walk away with that they can keep in the back of their mind? Your advice for them as entrepreneurs, as startups, as people trying to get their side hustle on, people who want to try to get into a corporation, whatever those three main takeaways that you can provide in terms of the wisdom that you've been able to gain over all these years.
Okay. For entrepreneurs, I would say never be afraid to ask for anything. But if you're asking for something, know that you have to be able to offer something in return. It's not all about you. You can add value to anybody out there. It doesn't matter who they are. They could be, the CEO of the world, if you want to put it that way. And there's always something that you can offer somebody in return. If not now, certainly later on.
Two
is focus. Stay focused on what it is you want to achieve and make sure that somebody has a need for it.
And three,
you're your best salesperson.
And how can people stay in contact with you, Nancy?
They can contact me through our website, which is www.boardbench.com, or they can send me an email at nmay@boardbench.com.
Nancy May, this has been such a pleasure. Nancy May, President, CEO of Board Bench Companies. We want to just thank you once again, and we're really looking forward to keeping in contact with you, hearing more as we go forward.
Thank you, Mitchell. I look forward to learning how I can be of service to you, too.
Take care now. Be good.
Okay, bye-bye.
In closing, let me ask for my listeners' help. First, please subscribe to my email list at MitchellChadrow.com/signup. You will get all the full interview transcripts, my ebook, 30 Tools to Start Up, where I talk about these free resources in show 006. You'll get the startup checklist, education and training materials, and other resources just by signing up at MitchellChadrow.com/signup.
Listen up, trusted friends. It's your business, it's your family, it's your life. Go out and live it.
Back at MitchellChadrow.com/signup, help me boost the rankings of the Listen Up Show, the Startup Entrepreneur Podcast, by providing a well-written review in iTunes. MitchellChadrow.com/iTunes. It helps other people find the show. If you actually need instructions on how to do this, you can find that back at MitchellChadrow.com/signup. Thank you so much for subscribing to my email list and providing a written review on iTunes. Until next time.